From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that's accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
I'm John Wells.
First this morning, we speak with historian, barrister, and author Jamie Susskind, who has written The Digital Republic on Freedom and Democracy in the 21st Century. It's an essential roadmap for bringing technology to heal in the service of democracy. Former Prime Minister of the UK, Tony Blair, says about our guest that he has established himself as one of the foremost thinkers on the transformative impact of the technology revolution.
And then, how to heal our land and reclaim our health is rooted, well, quite literally, in the soil on our farms and ranches. Farming practices over the last century have wreaked havoc upon our crops and brought declines in nutrients and beneficial compounds like those in fruits and vegetables that prevent cancer and fats in meat and dairy that control inflammation. We speak with David Montgomery and Anne Bickley, two scientists from Seattle who have written extensively on the topic.
The social power of digital technology is growing by the day. Code written by developers is used to decide whether we get a loan, whether our resumes get considered, or even whether we'll be fired from our job. Data collected by tech firms allows strangers to know us in ways we might not even know ourselves. We all have felt the burden of social media gone awry and full of falsehoods, of algorithms that discriminate. Our next guest, Jamie Susskind, is recognized as one of the leading intellectuals of the digital age and has advised governments around the world. With qualifications in law, history, and politics, he has outlined a plan to bring unregulated technology back into check. His new book is The Digital Republic on Freedom and Democracy in the 21st Century. Jamie Susskind, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
The problem that you outline is a problem that most of us didn't realize was really going on until maybe the last 5 or 10 years. I remember at the point, remember logging on to the internet for the first time, thinking what an incredible tool this is. And yet fast forward to where we are today with social media, especially, and the proliferation of falsehoods. We now wonder, wow, how did we get here? How did we get here, Jamie?
I think two things have happened, and they both happened at the same time. One is that very quickly, our systems have become significantly more capable. So there are non-human systems now that are capable of doing things which we previously thought only humans can do. And sometimes they can do them better than us. Secondly, we rely on digital technologies more now for all of our actions and interactions and transactions. Basically everything that makes up a meaningful life, whether it's work, whether it's sociability, whether it's romance, sport, entertainment, you name it, we rely on digital technologies. And so when you combine those two things, you have a situation that's not necessarily bad, but that is certainly risky. And the risk is this: whenever we interact with a digital technology, as we do more and more, we are subject to the rules that are coded into it. So when you use Twitter, you have to follow Twitter's rules about what may be said and how it may be said. And your choice about whether to comply with those rules isn't really optional. The tweet literally won't send if it's more than 280 characters. And this is something that actually scholars recognized in the 90s, which was that in cyberspace, they said, code operates as a kind of law. The rules within it force us to do one thing or another. And as we're increasingly surrounded by code, not just in cyberspace, but in meat space as well, we're surrounded by the rules that are contained in those bits of code. And those who write the rules are increasingly writing the rules of society. Now, as I say, they might be good rules, they might be wise rules, but sometimes they might not be as well. And so what we've witnessed is the rise of a new and strange form of power in our midst. And it's one with which previous generations never had to reckon.
Right. And these rules and laws that we agree to by using technology are largely unregulated. Why is that? I mean, I think it's very basically because we didn't know how to regulate. What would you say about that?
I agree. So, I mean, it is strange, isn't it? If you look at other areas of society where individuals or groups have acquired social power or social responsibility, I'm thinking about things like doctors or lawyers or pilots or bankers. Each of them has assumed a kind of social responsibility, but we don't just let them get on with their work and hope for the best that they'll exercise their power wisely. We impose them to rules and regulations and standards. But the tech industry, if it's right, as I've just described, that people in the tech industry now have a significant amount of power, that their algorithms can decide who gets a mortgage or a loan or a job, or their algorithms can decide on the health or otherwise of democratic deliberation online, it's strange that they aren't regulated in the same or a similar way. And the main reason I identify in the book is almost a kind of psychological one, or one of perception, which is that for a long time we've regarded technology as a kind of commercial thing, and we've seen it as consumers. Whereas actually now the digital is political, and we need to regard digital technology as citizens and not just as consumers. And that's quite a significant mindset change. It's a significant mindset change to look at the iPhone in your hand in a different way, to see it as part of a broader social structure that is actually profoundly changing the way we live. It's crept up on us slowly but surely, but here it is now. I mean, I think psychologically, one of the big turning points was 2016. Rightly or wrongly, the Brexit result here in the UK and the election of Donald Trump in the States, people on the sort of left or the center sat up and thought, well, actually something's going seriously wrong with digital technology here. Whether they were right to or not, I'm not going to comment, but that was in many ways a turning point.
In the first part of your book, you open with a quotation from Einstein: "We cannot solve our problems with the same thinking we use to create them." And at the same time, you also draw on folks that came before us and some of these republics. And we're not talking political republic, but we're talking about organizations, about a place, about countries, groups of countries. Ancient Greece, Rome, the framers of the U.S. Constitution in the beginning. What can we learn from those republics?
Thank you, John. So in the book, I'm feeling around and I'm trying to find a political philosophy that can help us to understand what's happening to us. And the one that I land on that I find really useful is, as you say, the philosophy of republicanism. Now, this is not the republicanism of the modern day capital R Republican Party, nor is it the republicanism associated with chopping the heads off kings and queens, although both of those things are obviously part of the ancient republican tradition. The republican philosophy that I speak of is something that can be traced back to ancient Rome, and it basically can be distilled into one main proposition, which is that it is wrong for one group in society to have too much unaccountable power over another. And that applies, crucially, even if the person with power or the group with power happens to be exercising it in a way that we don't like. So the Republican philosophy, and that applies even where the person who happens to have power is exercising it in a way that we like. So the Republican philosophy opposes not particular kings, but the idea of kingship itself. It opposes, the Republican argues for laws to protect tenants rather than just kinder landlords. The Republican argues for workers' rights rather than hoping for wiser bosses. The Republican argues for women's rights rather than just hoping and relying on men to treat women properly. The Republican is opposed not just to cruel slave masters, but to slavery itself, the institution of domination. And so right through history, you see this philosophy, which says, I don't care how nice or wise or kind you may be with the power at your disposal, too much power concentrated in one group or one hand, whether it's the hand of the state or the hand of a company or private corporation, is a problem. Now, I apply that to tech companies, and the analogy, I think, is pretty clear. My problem is never going to be with Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk. It's going to be with the idea of Mark Zuckerberg or Elon Musk, the idea that we all have to hope that they're going to make the right choices with the immense power at their command. The Republican doesn't hope. The Republican puts in place structures that makes people act responsibly, basically whether they want to or not.
Well, that not only makes sense to me, but it's refreshing. The concern that I have, and I just want to ask you, Xi Jinping, you know, autocratic organization over in China, and he has tried to control technology and with some success. Can a democracy actually do this? I mean, we can't even agree in this country on what to name a bridge, let alone take on something big like that. Do you think democracy can handle this?
It's a great question. I mean, I think there are two questions for the democracies of the world when you look at the Chinese example. One is, can we do it? Like, do we actually have the political institutions and the political will to tackle the problem? And I'll come back to that question in a second. The second is, how can we tackle this problem without starting to look like China, in the sense that the state itself becomes a problematic concentration of power? So you can see that the Chinese government is cracking down on the big tech companies, but that's not really much consolation for the fact that the most powerful user of technology in China is the Chinese government itself. So that's always the risk. And of course, the Republican is very alive to that risk. The Republican never wants to make the government too powerful in the course of trying to reduce unaccountable power elsewhere in society. In that respect, the Republican philosophy, I think, is very American in many ways. And of course, you know, many of the framers would have described themselves as Republican. On the question of whether we can actually make it happen, I don't have a crystal ball. What I would say is that some countries are doing it, and some countries are doing it better than others. So if you look, for instance, at the European Union is developing laws to govern social media platforms, laws to govern artificial intelligence, laws to govern all kinds of online harms. Here in the UK, there's a Conservative government which is trying to pass a law regulating the social media platforms, and in many respects is actually not a bad law. So some countries are doing better than others, which I think suggests that it is possible and that there are ways of doing it. Of course, no democracy is perfect. I mean, if I'm really honest, I look at the US just now, and I'm coming to visit DC in next week and speak to some policymakers and the like. I do think that there are really, really serious and deep political problems in the United States that, you know, it's upsetting for me as someone in his 30s, and, you know, people of my generation, I think, really look to the United States as a kind of beacon of how republicanism and how democracy can be enacted. But I think over the last few years, we've seen the darker side of the American political culture as well. I mean, I happen to believe that democracy is quite a fragile thing and is not an inevitable thing. And that I also don't believe in the inevitable success of the ideas that I advocate for. That may sound pessimistic in some ways, but what I would say is it's just a reason for us all to try hard and focus hard. Final point, things rise up the political agenda. So 20 years ago, I think, you know, people talking about climate change were still kind of outliers. And polls of what really mattered to people tended to reveal that climate change is very low down the list. It's still not at the top of the list, but it's much higher than it was. And again, I think that shows you that with sustained application and campaigning, important generational political issues can rise into the public consciousness where they weren't before. And, you know, the reason I do what I do is so that the same might happen with technology.
Jamie, as you're talking, it's reminding me of, you know, during the pandemic when social media platforms, you know, like Facebook or Twitter decided to start blocking content, that there was such a public health crisis and so many concerns about truth on social media platforms that they would block misinformation. And I'm wondering what you think about how effective that is. So this was generated from social media platforms deciding that, wow, we need to do something about this. It wasn't regulated from above. You say we need collective action. So what doesn't work about that sort of thing, and what works about that kind of action?
Well, I mean, my view is that the big social media platforms are placed in a very difficult position, because sometimes they're obviously over-censoring and sometimes they're obviously under-censoring. When are they over-censoring? A decent example is before the last presidential election, there was a New York Post article about Joe Biden's son, which contained allegations, which I think, regardless of who you were supporting in the election, you might think were relevant matters to be put into the public domain. The large social media platforms, Twitter in particular, I think, blocked it. You literally couldn't post it to the platform. That obviously led to real outrage and concern in some quarters. When do they under-censor? The most popular story on, I believe, the most shared story on Facebook in the first 3 months of 2021 was a bogus story about COVID, like quack science. The most shared story. So it's not a minor problem, the problem of disinformation. It is a major problem. And it's an example of where speech that was merely slightly harmful in the past with old forms of media, you know, any quack on a street corner could rave some conspiracy theory, but free speech meant they were allowed to do so and it didn't really harm anyone. Now that kind of thing can be seen by millions or even billions of people within seconds. And so the digital environment has fundamentally changed the way that information flows around society, and we haven't yet caught up with it. The way I would like to see social media platforms governed is at a systems level. So I think every major social media platform should have in place reasonable and proportionate systems to reduce the visibility of misinformation, particularly misinformation relating to things like, let's say, public health. What does that mean? It doesn't mean that you can criticize Facebook or Twitter every time something goes viral that is false, because that's going to happen. If you have a platform with a billion people on it, as Facebook does, people are going to say nonsense and some people are going to listen. But what you can ask them to do is have in place reasonable systems, proportionate systems for the reduction of the visibility of that kind of material. So for instance, if Facebook's algorithms are amplifying false content, or they don't have in place a sufficient number of content moderators or the like, that might be grounds for regulatory intervention, because what you're doing is saying that they don't have the systems in place. And that kind of systems level regulation is how other industries are regulated, some other industries. So for instance, nuclear power plants, you don't have inspectors crawling around the whole time, but what they do is they inspect the processes and procedures that you have in place to make sure that they are adequate. And I would have something similar for social media platforms. Now, there might be reasons why that's not possible in the United States. There are certainly some constitutional scholars who say that the First Amendment would just prohibit such a law. I don't know if that's right, because I know that some scholars certainly disagree with that position. But it's what's being tried out over here in Europe, and I think it will lead to better results.
It's interesting that you express your concern over American democracy, and certainly we do as well. And looking back to the framers of the Constitution and what they intended and how they could never have foreseen some of the forces that are changing our world and our democracy as we speak. When we talk about the First Amendment and free speech, this largely is what perpetuates this world of social media doing what it's doing. How in the UK, for example, do you deal with this question of free speech, and how is it regulated? And especially maybe you could go into what you brought up before about Brexit.
It's such an interesting question. And actually, the difference can be explained quite simply. The First Amendment tradition, the First Amendment tradition is essentially obsessed with stopping the government from passing laws restricting freedom of speech. And that tradition is based on an expectation that the main threat to freedom of speech is the government, government censors and the like. And, you know, a few hundred years ago, that was probably a safe assumption. These days, there are, however, other threats to free speech. And so, for instance, I think a platform like Facebook, with my Republican hat on, I think it has the potential to be a major menace to free speech, even if it doesn't actually do things that we would disapprove of, even if it hasn't wielded all of the power within its control. The way that free speech works in Europe and in Canada and the like is slightly different. You have a right to free speech, so individuals have a right to free speech, but that right to free speech is not inviolable. So there are some circumstances in which it can be restricted, you know, for national security or the like, which, by the way, is kind of the same in the United States. You can't say anything in the US. There's still laws against defamation or fraud and things like that. So it's not an unlimited free-for-all. But there is also, what's fascinating about the European and Canadian model is that instead of just saying the government may not restrict free speech, there is actually a positive duty on the government to create an environment in which speech is free. And so what that means is that the government not only is entitled to, but is required to pass laws that stop corporations from dominating the speech environment, which stop non-government actors from threatening speech as well. So what you have is not just a negative duty on government not to interfere with free speech, but a positive duty on government to promote a free speech environment. And, you know, frankly, I think that is the more appropriate model in the digital age, where the threats to free speech don't just come from the government anymore. They come from other places in society. And I would add that, you know, since Europe has adopted that definition of free speech, the democracies of Europe have not been plunged into darkness or autocracy. It has proved to be a workable and durable approach. So that is one of the reasons why I think countries other than the US are finding it slightly easier to imagine imaginative solutions to the problems of social media, because they see the role of the government as being to create and foster a healthy environment for democratic deliberation, not just to back off.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, thanks for joining us. We're speaking with Jamie Susskind, who has written The Digital Republic on Freedom and Democracy in the 21st Century. Jamie, a while back, a couple years ago, on both sides of the aisle, became kind of popular to talk about breaking up some of these technology companies. And I apologize for being so simplistic, because antitrust legislation is very complex, so I don't want to minimize it down to a soundbite. But somebody told us on the program a couple years ago that the litmus test for current antitrust in the United States is it hurting the consumer? And in the case of Amazon, consumers are all saying, hey, we get it fast, we get it faster, and we get it less expensive. How could we complain? Is that true? I mean, I know it's simplistic, but will the current antitrust legislation get us where we need to go, or do we have to rewrite everything?
Yes, it's true. The dominant school of thought, the kind of Chicago school of thought, it's known as in the United States for a long time, has been, the touchstone has been, is this merger or acquisition good for consumers? Is this behavior by a dominant entity good for consumers? And in fact, it's sometimes even more narrow than that. The question often is simply asked whether it increases prices. Now, it is complicated, so let's just try and sort of break it down. The first question is whether, even just in economic terms, that model that you've just described is adequate. And if you look at something like Google or Facebook, these are not economically offensive companies. Quite the contrary. They give us amazing stuff, and they give us it for free, or rather they give us it in exchange for our attention and our information. But these are things that most of us consider that we are willing to surrender, rightly or wrongly, as part of the commercial bargain for what we get in response. So it's very hard to identify, as you say, with an Amazon or with a Google or a Facebook, commercial harm to consumers. The law does recognize, though, that when a company becomes too dominant, you know, like a Facebook or a Google, and it becomes basically impossible to challenge it, that may that may pose problems to consumers. But again, if companies aren't behaving in a way that the regulator considers objectionable with the great power at their disposal, they may not step in. In my book, The Digital Republic, I say that this kind of this whole edifice of law is slightly outdated, because what we should really be asking, what we're really asking when we talk about antitrust law is this: have these companies become too big? And the answer to that question can't just be measured in consumer welfare. And this was my point from earlier about having to think like citizens and not just consumers. It might be good for us as consumers that Facebook is a dominant company, but it might be bad for us as citizens because it corrupts the democratic deliberation environment. But the fact that something, for instance, is corrosive to democracy is not part of the antitrust test as it's currently applied. So antitrust regulators aren't interested in that. They're just interested in the economic questions. If you're like me and you regard many of the very large tech companies as authentically political entities in their own right, as well as corporations, they are, I'm not saying they're states, but because they exert social power, they are political in some way, then what you should be looking for in an antitrust regime is one which doesn't just ask, is this good for consumers, but asks, is this good for citizens? Is this good for the republic? And if the answer to those questions is no, then that might trigger, in my world, regulatory intervention as well. So it's about reframing, for me, it's about reframing the question about not just being about prices, not just being about consumer welfare, not just being about economics, but about the broader social and political scene. And if you accept, as I do, that digital power is an authentic political force, then we need to have some way of breaking it up when it gets too big.
The book is The Digital Republic. Our guest, Jamie Susskind, has written this essential roadmap for bringing technology to heal in the service of democracy. Jamie, these are such important questions, and it's so important for us as consumers to study books like yours. So thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's been a real pleasure hearing from you.
It's been a fascinating chat for me too. Thank you so much.
Next, we turn our conversation to food science and soil biology with two experts. David Montgomery is professor at the University of Washington and a geomorphologist. Anne Bickley is a biologist and environmental planner. Their work includes a trilogy of books about soil health, microbiomes, and farming. Now they're back with a new book that looks at the science to illustrate how the health of soil ripples through to that of crops, livestock, and, well, ultimately us. The book is called What Your Food Ate, How to Heal Our Land and Reclaim Our Health. David and Anne, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Well, we're delighted to have you here. And Anne, I'll start with you. I was curious about the quote, you are what you eat. And I looked it up this morning on the Google. And apparently in 1826, Jean Bartlett Savarin said, "Tell me what you eat and I will tell you what you are." Well, that's a couple hundred years ago. Yeah, interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think it's sort of, you know, common sense, or, you know, our gut tells us, oh, you are what you eat. You know, we've all certainly eaten something and either felt great or bad, defending. But yeah. What we do in the book is we really unpack that, and we go quite a bit deeper than just the standard you are what you eat, because all of these things that come into our body, first, of course, they need to get into our crops. They need to get into livestock, and then they need to make it to our plate. And in the research that David and I have done for not only this book, but also for the previous books, it turns out that the biology of the soil, so what do I mean by the biology of the soil, that big general biology out there? I'm mostly talking about, though not exclusively, the tiniest creatures that live in the soil, from bacteria and even viruses to these other single-celled organisms, the archaea and protozoans. And then, of course, there's some larger organisms, earthworms and things like that. But that whole collection, that whole community of organisms is largely responsible for how things move out of the soil and into the green body of a plant. And then, of course, from the plant body, whatever and whoever is eating that plant can then take in those things. And there's three things we focus on in the book in terms of this ripple effect from the soil up into us. And it's fats, it's phytochemicals, which are just naturally occurring compounds that plants make every single day in their bodies. And then it's a group of things that are go by the name of micronutrients. But that's pretty simple. That's just vitamins and mineral elements, like, say, iron or zinc. So we unpack all of that in the book and show how soil health and how we farm specifically influences all the creatures in the soil and how that in turn influences what ends up in our food and thus in our bodies.
And David, what is the role of bacteria and fungi in providing the macronutrients?
Well, in terms of the macronutrients are sort of a different story than the micronutrients and the fats and the phytochemicals. And there's far less evidence that farming practices affects macronutrients, the sort of the basic building blocks of food, you know, sort of the essence of what makes a tomato. But when you look at what affects the flavor of that tomato, that's where the things like the micronutrients, the fats, the specific amino acids come in. And that's where a lot of the action really is focused in terms of how soil life and the health of the soil influences what gets into our food. And it's really through the way our farming practices would affect that is through either cultivating or disrupting the beneficial symbiotic, the mutually beneficial relationships between soil life and the life of a crop. And how that works is that if you look at what a plant does, it has the ability to photosynthesize. It can take carbon out of the atmosphere, merge it with water, build sugars. It's a pretty unique and amazing biochemical process that creates food out of scratch. And the life in the soil really can't do that. Fungi, for example, they decompose things. They can't photosynthesize. So plants will actually take, it turns out, most plants will do this, a portion of what they make through photosynthesis, and they exude it or leak it out of their roots to feed the life in the soil that will then consume that food, that buffet that the plant is setting for the subterranean table, and they'll metabolize the sugars, the fats, the proteins that plants are putting out into the soil and make things like plant growth promoting hormones or turn them into other compounds that benefit the health of plants. And that soil life is also very good at getting things like mineral elements like zinc or iron, that some of those micronutrients Anne talked about that our bodies need. We don't need much of them, but we need that little bit an awful lot. And plants are really good, I'm sorry, the soil life, fungi in particular, are really good at serving as root extensions for plants. And they'll deliver that material to the plant in exchange for a cut of the sugary exudates that the plant is making. So it's disrupting the original underground economy is how farming can actually influence and disrupt what's getting into our food. And it's more in the range of things that are not traditionally considered nutrients, but that are very important for maintaining human health, that help our bodies run smoothly, the micronutrients, the phytochemicals, and certain mixes of fats in livestock.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with David Montgomery and Anne Bickley. Their book is What Your Food Ate, How to Heal Our Land and Reclaim Our Health. Now, Anne and David, I've just finished a big bowl of, well, I haven't quite finished, kale, because it's very hard to eat. You have to, you know, massage it, and then you chew it, and you chew it, and you keep chewing it. And all of that work to eat what I think of as, you know, one of the best foods you can eat, I think I went through all that, and what if it's not possessing the nutrients that it may have possessed several hundred years ago, even if I bought organic kale, which it is? What likely is going on with that kale right now?
Well, no matter how it was grown, it's better than a bag of potato chips. So there's sort of two key things in terms of thinking about, you know, the nutritional profile, shall we say, of the food we eat. And one is just what we're eating. And that kale is good in terms of it's rich in fiber. It will have a lot of phytochemicals no matter how it's grown. But whether it has as much as it could have would be the real question. And we did some testing that I'm forgetting the numbers on and might remember of kale that she grew in her own yard to look at, to compare with USDA standards, and restored the soil in our yard. It's beautiful, healthy, fertile soil. And our kale is kind of off the charts in terms of,
I think there one particular
calcium sulforaphane, or
it was calcium. It was really high in, and it was one of the vitamins. It was really high in.
K?
Yeah, it might have been K.
Yeah.
This was a few years back. The other thing that's going on is a little bit depends on the cultivar that you're growing, because different plants will take in different amounts of things. So that can also affect things. But there's something sort of bigger at play here. And I don't know per se that it's going on with kale. It's something maybe more typical of grains or potatoes or something. And that's something called... it's called nutrient dilution. And basically, when we breed crops, say we breed wheat, and it used to have 10 kernels per head, and we breed wheat to have 20 kernels per head, the plant is not necessarily adjusting the abundance of, say, iron or zinc that it pulls in. So it's spreading that same amount of that mineral element through twice as many grains, and so that dilutes the amount of iron or zinc or what have you in each wheat kernel. And say you have like a small fingerling potato and you have a big giant russet. The plant is pulling in the same amount of a mineral element from the soil, but it's spreading it through, you know, a potato four times as big. That's diluting the concentration or the density. That's why we talk about nutrient density in the book, and it's something that I'm sure some of your listeners have heard of. And so what we want foods packed with nutrients rather than diluted and spread through more of the food, because you're then taking in more calories to get the same amount of some really critical nutrients.
That's exactly what I was thinking of as you were talking. We have to eat more and more food. Thus, the obesity epidemic, which is probably only a part of the obesity epidemic. The other part is that we're not eating healthy foods. We're eating foods that don't really count, but that have a tremendous amount of calories. So when we go back to farming practices over the last century, what are the most egregious practices that have resulted in a loss of nutrients to the soil itself?
It's a really interesting... It's an interesting story to look at that in the historical development of farming over the last few centuries. And as a geologist, of course, the look backwards is fascinating to me. But you can really, I think, sort of pin the inadvertent decline in the nutrient density of crops today on the adoption of a few key practices that characterize modern conventional agriculture. A lot of tillage, plowing of the soil, and the overuse of synthetic nitrogen fertilizers, which are soluble nitrogen fertilizers, which is fairly different than organic fertilizers that are rich in nitrogen, which are not typically very soluble, and then functioning and focusing on growing very few crops in the same field. Monocultures are just two crop rotations, like corn and soybeans, for example. And when you look at those combination of practices, the disturbance from tillage, the alterations to the communities of soil life that result from very high applications of nitrogen, and the changes in the relationship between plants and their symbiotic partners in the soil, fungi in particular, it affects things like mineral micronutrient uptake and phytochemical production. And diversity, I mean, that's if you grow a diversity of crops in a field, it's a recipe for having lots of different exudates, lots of microbes, lots of microbial partners for a crop to then work with to access micronutrients and so forth. So it's not so much that the soil really would be running out of nutrients as a result of farming practices, but we're disrupting the delivery system for those nutrients. Some soils are short on certain key elements based on the vicissitudes of the geology underneath the farm. But in looking into this problem, we've really come to think that it's more of a biological problem in terms of disrupting the key elements of biology. And there's actually fairly simple fixes in terms of going to no-till farming without the use of major amounts of herbicide, which is possible. It has to be done carefully, and people have looked into ways for doing that, and we write about it. But you know, ditching the plow, covering up with cover crops to always keep a living root in the growing in the soil to produce those exudates, and then growing a diversity of crops in the same field, having diverse crop rotations, that's a recipe for bringing soil life back and reversing the declines, we think, that we've seen over the last 80 years or so with the adoption of what we now call conventional agriculture.
David, what is a geomorphologist, and how does that inform your work?
A geomorphologist is the kind of geographer that studies the surface of the earth. So I study, you know, and my day job as a professor of geomorphology, I look at the evolution of topography, what shapes landscapes. And when you think about that, one of the key things that matters the most is soil. Is there soil on the land at all? How is soil made from breaking down rocks? And I was trained to think about soil building as a process, literally of like smashing up rocks to make soil, kind of a deal. But it turns out that the biology is such a huge part of it in terms of building fertile soil. And Anne as a biologist and me as a geologist, it's kind of what we've been working on and writing on is kind of on the interface, the boundary between our respective expertise. So what I've tended to bring to the partnership is a long-term perspective of a geologist, but also sort of, you know, what is the sort of the mineral part, the sort of the basic template that one needs to build fertile soil? And Anne's bringing the biology, and it's the combination that really works to help explain both the degradation of soil and our opportunities to rebuild healthy, fertile soils on a global scale, which is really should be one of the most optimistic, I think, environmental stories around the world today. It can be done.
Anne and David, I can't think of a more passionate topic. I mean, a passionate topic defined as anybody you speak to about it, they have very strong feelings about it. Other than GMO, when you talk with someone about GMO, they're passionately for it, they're passionately against it. Some are in the middle, but most of them are either really for it or really against it. Take a couple of minutes, both of you, and help our listeners and help us understand what's really going on with GMOs.
I'll start off maybe with sort of a bigger picture thing on GMOs. And you're absolutely right. You really pegged it. You're either for them or you're against them, passionately. One thing actually that's missed by those who are, you know, not so keen on GMOs is that there's a lot of talk about it's the actual, let's just talk about glyphosate, because there's the GM crops, there's crops that have been modified to be able to withstand this herbicide. And there's a lot of concern about what is this actually doing to the crop, to the GM crop? Is it changing it nutritionally? Is it changing it in some way, introducing toxins or harmful things into that crop that then becomes a part of the human food supply? And there's those who say, absolutely, yes, that's happening. I don't know, because there's also been research done that shows, oh, well, you know, the corn is still corn nutritionally. I think where the bigger problem is on that, that's often not talked about, is what glyphosate is doing to the soil and what and the degree to which farmers around the world are relying on this herbicide. That to me is a much bigger problem than whether or not, because I think that's not totally determined yet, whether or not there is something missing from the food or something in the food that shouldn't be there. And so there's this whole other baggage that comes with GM crops. And in the case of those bred to resist glyphosate, it's all of these other practices that the use of glyphosate allows for. And that goes from, you know, these no-till systems where, sure, they're not plowing, but some farmers are using tons and tons of glyphosate to deal with the weed problem. And then you're getting glyphosate-resistant weeds. And it's still not what we really are after with soil health, which is we're looking to get biology, you know, back into the soil. So if GM crops are taking us down the wrong road in terms of soil health, then, you know, we don't need to go in that direction.
Yeah, and it's not so much that glyphosate, you know, like wipes out the life in the soil. I mean, the bacterial levels tend to be, you know, fairly stable with. What is very clear in the research that we've looked at is that, you know, herbicides in general and glyphosate in particular will affect the community composition. So not so much how many bacteria there are in the soil and whether there's life there, but who's there and what are they doing and how does that actually relate to the crops? And that's a big cause of concern. There's a number of studies that have shown that, you know, fungal root infestations increase with the applications of glyphosate, which means that then you are needing antifungals and other sort of pesticides sort of in the wake of it. And there's a whole sort of talk of an agrochemical treadmill where once we go to intensive nitrogen fertilization, it can actually undermine the health defenses, the health program that crops evolved with in terms of relations with soil life. And that means we need to do more to actually protect the health of crops, which ends up in, you know, meaning more pesticides and more herbicides like glyphosate in the relation to GMOs. You know, one of the main reasons it's become popular is that it's really the easy button for weed control. Because, you know, with the gene that's spliced into the glyphosate-resistant crops, you can spray your crop or you spray the land before you plant your crop. Whichever way you do it, your crop is not going to be hurt, but every other plant is going to be taken out. That's a great way to kill a lot of weeds really fast. It's the easy button for weed control. So there's an inherent appeal to farmers, but what came along with it? And that's where the disrupting soil life and undermining soil health and undermining, therefore, the health of crops, as we go into in the book, you know, the research is still, there's still lots to be done in terms of learning it, but I think it's very instructive on looking at the point that Anne was making, that when thinking about and talking about GMOs, it's really important to think about the practices that come along with them, because therein may lie some of the bigger potential harms. You look at the patents for glyphosate, it was first patented as a metal chelator. It's something to bind up metals. Oh, things like trace elements, trace minerals, micronutrients that we were talking about earlier. It's good at doing that. It's also patented as a antibiotic, an antimicrobial. And so, you know, the idea that it might disrupt soil life is not so far-fetched for, you know, applying an antibiotic to the soil or having plants zooted out of their roots. What does that then do to the gut microbiome of, you know, livestock or people that would eat crops or products that would have glyphosate in it? And that's an open question. There's European studies that have looked at those effects in livestock and argued for significant impacts. I don't think we're aware of any studies that have looked at the human microbiome, but it's a very legitimate question to ask as to whether it's a wise thing to be spraying all over our farms and our food before harvest the way it is today. So I think in short, our sort of, you know, opinion about GMOs is that, frankly, I'm agnostic on the basic idea of genetic engineering. I could see potential for good and I could see potential for bad. But it's some of the unintended side effects, like we've just been discussing, that I think are really serious concerns today that deserve a lot more attention in the polarized debates about GMOs.
That's big. That's all big. I wanted to ask you, well, there's something that you say in the book, industrialized organic farms can destroy fertile soil as surely as thoughtful conventional farmers can rebuild the health of their fields. So when we have industrialized organic farms, what are we doing wrong there? Are we tilling? Are we not rotating crops? Is that the problem? So even when we're buying organic, we might not be purchasing something that is what it should be for us.
Here's the weird thing about organic and the National Organic Program, and it's just the way this whole segment of farming developed, and it's largely driven, and for good reason, by a list of things not to do. Don't do this, don't do this, cannot use this, cannot use that. And in industrialized, and most organic farmers comply with all of that. One of the biggest problems with these larger industrial farms is they do rely on tillage. And so far in the organic program, the amount and level of tillage is not really addressed. And that's a problem.
Yeah, if you look back through history and you look at the, you know, what the Romans did to their farmland or the Greeks did to their farmland, you know, they didn't have any assistance from the agrochemical industry in terms of degrading their land. It was done using organic, what would be today called organic methods. And the villain of that story from societies long ago really is tillage and excessive plowing. And why is that? When you till the soil, you're breaking it up. You accelerate microbial breakdown of the soil organic matter. And that's basically shorthand for dead stuff. You know, basically the remains of other organisms, and particularly microbes in the soil, their bodies, once they die, become soil organic matter. And because things that were once alive, they are actually full of things like the mineral micronutrients that new life needs. And so they're also full of some of the macronutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, in particular. So they're like little fertilizer bombs. So you can look at soil organic matter as nature's fertilizer. And if you till a lot, it basically burns it up pretty fast. There's a study done a few, 20 years ago or so that looked at how you can basically till, fresh soil, of good soil in the temperate zones for about 50 years to maybe a century before you burn through the organic matter. And in the tropics, it only takes about 5 to 10 years. So if you look back at past, that's been sort of a major theme in the history of farming, of the degradation of land that has been tilled too often too long. Now, if you have an organic farm today, it's not like you can't till it, but if you don't have an abundant source of organic matter to replenish what would be a loss through frequent tilling, you can degrade the health soil pretty quick smart, or maybe quick stupid. I'm not sure what the right way to phrase that would be. Australians have a different way of speaking. But that's where, if you had an organic farm where you had access to a whole lot of compost and mulch and maybe an urban waste stream for organic matter, that you weren't worried about conserving your organic matter because you had an abundance of it, you could plow to your heart's content and maintain soil health and fertility. Very few large-scale industrialized farms have access to that kind of organic matter, which means they have to grow it through cover crops. That's where tillage really comes into play as a really, as a bad thing for maintaining soil health, is if you're at all going to be limited by access to soil organic matter.
Yeah.
So there's a wide range of practices in the organic world, and there's a wide range of practices in the conventional farming world. What we're arguing in the book is that the new North Star for farming, across the board, should be practices that build soil health, and that farming should be viewed as good if it is done in a way that leaves the land in better shape biologically than if you weren't farming it.
What Your Food Ate, the book is written by David Montgomery and Ann Bickley. We want to thank you so much for joining us. We hope you will come back. We wish you success with your latest project here. And thank you for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
You bet. Our pleasure.
Yeah, thanks. We're happy to come back anytime.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a comment. If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.